We're going to read again, continuing our reading. We're going to read the whole of Daniel chapter 5. It's entitled Belshazzar's Feast. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. In the same hour the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you." Now, excuse me, the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round your neck, and you shall be third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for another, be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this, and you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, And this writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written. Many, many, tekel upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, which I believe is the singular version of the word farsin, which is in verse 25, in case you're wondering why Daniel would use a different word, but it's just the singular version of the same word. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold round his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Amen. I'm going to start today with a question. And the question is, what do the following well-known phrases or expressions have in common? What do these expressions have in common? To bite the dust, by the skin of your teeth, a drop in the bucket, and lambs to the slaughter. To bite the dust, by the skin of your teeth, a drop in the bucket, or lambs to the slaughter. Perhaps you think they've got nothing at all in common. But they are all well-known phrases in the English language which have their origins in the Bible, particularly in the Authorised Version and other early English Bible versions from the 17th century and earlier. And someone has counted that there's a huge number of expressions widely used in the English language that originated in the Bible, were first used in the Bible and have come into our language. And you maybe noticed another such phrase in the passage that we read from Daniel 5, and that is, the writing is on the wall. And that's a commonly used expression today for an enterprise or something that is doomed to failure. We say, the writing is on the wall for it. And I'm sure over the past week, some people have been thinking, when they've been hearing about all the parties and so on that happened in Downing Street during the COVID pandemic, they have been thinking and maybe saying that for Boris Johnson, the writing is on the wall. Whether that turns out to be the case remains to be seen. If you're a football fan, perhaps thinking about Norwich City, who have been at the bottom of the Premiership for all of the season and who lost again yesterday, the pundits will be saying the writing is on the wall, because it looks like at the end of the season they'll almost certainly be relegated from the Premiership. So the title of today's sermon is The Writing is on the Wall. And we're going to be looking at the events of Daniel chapter 5. And on the face of it, it's about King Belshazzar. So initially we're going to look at a number of things about King Belshazzar that we find in the passage. And they all loosely begin with the letter D. After we've done that, hopefully then we'll try to see what lessons we can learn from this for ourselves. These events took place in 539 BC. What relevance can they possibly have for us in the 21st century? Well, hopefully we'll see that they do have much relevance. So we come then, first of all, first thing about Belshazzar is he was a definite king, or he definitely was a king of Babylon. That seems like perhaps a strange thing to say, but for many years, Bible skeptics would have told us that the Bible was wrong and that there never was a king of Babylon called Belshazzar. They claimed that from other ancient documents that they knew who all the kings of Babylon were, and Belshazzar wasn't on that list. And so they claimed that the Bible had got it wrong. They also claimed that they knew who the king of Babylon was at the time when the Babylonian Empire fell to the Medes and Persians. And that's what happens at the end of this chapter, Daniel 5. And they said again it wasn't Belshazzar. It was a man called Nabonidus who was king when the Babylonian Empire fell. So that was what skeptics said for many years. However, in 1854, everything changed. when four clay cylinders were excavated from the city of Ur of the Chaldees, well known to us from as being the original home of Abraham. And these cylinders, now called the Nabonidus cylinders, are housed in the British Museum in London. And they contain a prayer written by King Nabonidus. And it was a prayer to the moon god, who was one of the gods that he worshipped. And the prayer was along the lines, "It was for Belshazzar, the eldest son, my offspring." So that confirmed that there was a man called Belshazzar, that he was the son of Nabonidus, king of Babylon. So as far as Belshazzar's existence was concerned, the Bible was right all along. And then later in the 19th century, another ancient document was translated, and this was a document about King Nabonidus, and it showed that he spent quite a lot of his reign when he was king of Babylon away from the city of Babylon itself in other parts of his empire. And because he was away so much, he had appointed his son Belshazzar to be a sort of co-regent, co-king, joint king along with him. Nabonidus was the actual king, but as far as day-to-day things in Babylon were concerned, it was Belshazzar who was on the throne and who was the king in Babylon. And it was Belshazzar who was in charge in Babylon at the time whenever the Medes and Persians came and took over the kingdom. So again, the Bible was right all along, as it always has been when its historical accuracy has been challenged. There's another little detail in the passage that we read in Daniel 5 which backs up this historical situation. You'll notice in verse 7 of the passage, when Belshazzar is offering various things to the people, to the person who could interpret the dream, that one of the things he offers is that they can be third place in the kingdom. Not second place like Pharaoh offered to Joseph whenever he interpreted his dreams, but third place. And that was because Nabonidus was number one, his son Belshazzar was number two, and so the successful interpreter of the writing would be number three. So that just little detail just helps to confirm the historical situation. The other thing we need to address is the relationship of Belshazzar to Nebuchadnezzar. From the passage, you would naturally assume that Belshazzar was the son, the immediate son of Nebuchadnezzar, but all the extra biblical records seem to agree that Nabonidus, Belshazzar wasn't the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but the son of Nabonidus. But it appears that Nabonidus, the king of Babylon, was married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, and so Belshazzar was actually Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. And once again, the skeptics would be quick to say, there you are again, another mistake in the Bible. But again, that's not the case, because the word that's used for father or son here in this passage can, I understand, be equally legitimately translated as grandfather, grandson, or even as ancestor, descendant. And so there's really no issue with the accuracy of scriptures here, and you may see a footnote in your Bible to that effect, depending on which particular version you have. So Belshazzar was a definite king. He was definitely a king in Babylon at the time whenever these events happened. We come then in the second place to see Belshazzar, a defiant king. Belshazzar, a defiant king. And in our passage, Belshazzar throws a massive party for 1,000 of his nobles and his wives and his concubines. This was not an unusual thing for a great Eastern ruler to do. You'll remember a similar incident happens in the book of Esther, Esther chapter 1. I'm sure we're not given any details, but I'm sure the menu was something to behold. I'm sure there were loads of courses, and the location would no doubt have been the throne room in Babylon, which would have been a very dramatic place for a feast. And it was some party, we're told, particularly with regard to the wine. The wine seemed to be flowing freely. Five times in those first few verses we read about the drinking of wine that was going on. I'm not going to attempt to describe to you what the atmosphere would have been like. I can leave that to your imagination. Get 1,000 men in a room and ply them with alcohol, and it wouldn't be a place for the faint-hearted or for anyone with a shred of true godliness about them. And I'm sure Daniel was glad that he hadn't been invited to this feast. But undoubtedly this was more than just a booze-up. It was also a religious festival in honour of the gods of Babylon. And as king of Babylon, Belshazzar would have been a kind of king-priest. As well as ruling the people, he would also have led the people in their worship of the false gods of Babylon. So after the wine had its effect on Belshazzar, or maybe this was his idea all along, he plans that the gold and silver vessels that had come from the temple in Jerusalem, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought, he commanded that those be brought and used to drink the wine. We read in Daniel chapter 1 that those articles had been put by King Nebuchadnezzar into the treasure house of his God, where they had remained for the 50 plus years since they had been brought from Jerusalem. But Belshazzar, in his drunken logic, thinks it would be a good idea to drink their wine from these gold and silver vessels as they worship the gods of Babylon, the gods of gold, silver, iron, wood and stone. Now there were quite a few of these vessels. We read in Ezra chapter 1, or in the book of Ezra anyway, that there were 5,400 individual items in that consignment that came from Jerusalem. And God had commanded that these vessels be used solely for his worship in the temple. So in deliberately using them to drink wine from in the honour of the gods of Babylon, Belshazzar was defying and blaspheming the true God, the God of Israel. In effect, he's saying to God and to the assembled gathering that the gods of Babylon are much more superior to the God of Israel. He's defying the God of Israel, a bit like the way we saw a few weeks ago when I was here, that Goliath defied the armies of the living God. Belshazzar was defying the God of Israel by his actions. This was an act of breathtaking sacrilege and blasphemy and defiance of the true God of Israel. So we have Belshazzar, a defiant king. We move then on to Belshazzar, a dismayed king. Belshazzar, a dismayed king. Suddenly, as we read the passage, the scene changes. The raucous atmosphere that had persisted turns to silence. Silence, that is, apart from the scratching noise of the fingers of a hand etching out a message on the plaster of the wall behind the lampstand. The only other sound was the sound of Belshazzar's knees knocking. Now the change in Belshazzar is dramatic. He turns white as a sheet as the blood drains from his face. His head is in a spin. Verse 4 apparently literally says the joints of his loins were loosed. And that sounds like he lost control of some of his bodily functions. In a moment, the proud, defiant king had lost any remnants of dignity that he still retained after the drink had done its work, and he turns into a quivering jelly. So what does Belshazzar do? Well, he does what great kings in this situation always seem to do. He sent for his astrologers, his soothsayers, and his so-called wise men of Babylon. And just like when Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar previously in similar situations had called for their wise men, they haven't a clue. I don't think it was a case that they didn't know the words, because the words apparently were written in Aramaic, a language which they would have understood. But they hadn't a clue what they meant. They weren't able to give the meaning. And that makes Belshazzar feel even worse. He is greatly troubled. Then in comes the queen to the rescue. This is most likely the queen mother, because as we've seen already in verse 3, Daniel or Belshazzar's wives and his concubines were all at the feast. So this is probably the queen mother, and may well have been Belshazzar's own mother. And the queen comes, and she in effect tells Belshazzar to pull himself together. And then she reminds him in verse 11 of this man Daniel, who has a history of being the go-to man in situations like this, and Daniel is brought. Years earlier, Daniel had been promoted to one of the main officials in the kingdom by Nebuchadnezzar after he had interpreted a dream for Nebuchadnezzar. But it seems at this point that he's not as prominent as he once was, and perhaps Belshazzar, when he became king, didn't want someone who was a representative of the true God to have such a high place in his administration. Daniel is brought into Belshazzar's presence in front of all these thousand lords. And Belshazzar doesn't exactly give him a warm welcome. You'll notice how he begins his little speech. He says, "Are you that Daniel, one of the captives from Judah that Nebuchadnezzar brought to Babylon?" So there's still a good bit of arrogance, a good bit of defiance in Belshazzar yet. He may be very troubled. He may even be desperate, but he's not yet humbled or repentant. He puts Daniel in the picture, including telling them the various goodies that are on offer to the person who can read and interpret the writing, and then Daniel speaks. So we've seen Belshazzar, the dismayed king. We now come to Belshazzar, a Daniel prosecuted king. As you read what Daniel says to Belshazzar, it sounds a bit like Belshazzar is on trial and Daniel is giving the case for the prosecution. He begins by telling Belshazzar, first of all, that he can keep his stuff and give it to somebody else, but Daniel will give him the interpretation anyway. He's not interested in anything that Belshazzar has to offer. You'll notice also that Daniel doesn't tell him what he wants to know straight away. The king wants to know what the words mean. Daniel doesn't do that. Daniel is God's man, and he's in charge. He's calling the shots now, not the great Belshazzar, and he's going to go at his pace. First, he sets the context of Belshazzar's behaviour. He gives him a history lesson, telling him about how great Nebuchadnezzar had been as a king. The implication perhaps is that Belshazzar wasn't just as great as Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel stresses that Nebuchadnezzar was great because God had made him great. The God Most High had made him great. That was the source of his greatness. But then he goes on to tell how Nebuchadnezzar had become proud and how that same God had humbled him and removed him from his throne. And we read about that in the first reading in Daniel chapter 4, how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar and brought him down, removed him from his throne, and caused him to live like an animal for some time, until he came to recognize that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whoever he wills. So Daniel has given him the background, and the background is very significant in the case that Daniel is making against Belshazzar, the case that God has against Belshazzar. So Daniel then goes ahead and presses charges, as it were, against Belshazzar. And this would have taken a lot of courage for Daniel to do. Belshazzar was a mighty potentate, and he wanted to know what the writing meant. But Daniel doesn't tell him that. Daniel presses charges against him and tells him what he's guilty of. And there are three charges we see in verses 22 and 23. Charge 1, Daniel charges that even though Belshazzar knew about all that had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, that he had failed to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's experience, and he had failed to humble himself like Nebuchadnezzar had. You might have thought from what the Queen Mother said in her when she started talking about Daniel, you might have thought by what she said that this was the first time that Belshazzar had known about these things. But Daniel doesn't let Belshazzar away with that. He says, "You knew all this. You knew all that had happened to Nebuchadnezzar and how God raised him up and then God brought him down and humbled him and how he came to worship the true God." And yet, Daniel says, you knew all this, and yet you failed to humble yourself before this Most High God. We're talking about Daniel's charges against Belshazzar, but could this be true of anyone here, either here or listening later? Could you be failing to humble yourself before this great God? Charge number two. Daniel charges Belshazzar with lifting himself up against the Lord of heaven. This glorifying of himself and his defying of the true God had found its climax in drinking from the sacred vessels taken from the temple in Jerusalem and using them to worship the false gods of Babylon. Charge number three. This is at the end of verse 23. Daniel charges Belshazzar with failing to give glory to the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all his ways. The very God who had made him, and the very God who sustained him and kept him every day, Belshazzar had defied and had failed to glorify. Could that be true of anyone here today as well, or anyone listening later? Could it be that you have failed to give glory to the God who gives you breath and sustains you in all your ways? So Daniel brings these three charges, and he says to Belshazzar, it's because you're guilty of these three things that God has sent the hand, the fingers of the hand, to write the message on the wall. So we have the Daniel prosecuted king. We come fifthly to Belshazzar, the doomed king. Belshazzar, the doomed king. Having presented the charges against Belshazzar, it was now time for the verdict. It was time for the verdict to be pronounced, and the verdict was on the wall. The verdict was in the writing on the wall. Daniel then proceeds to read the writing and to give the interpretation. The words themselves, many, many, tikal, farsin, are all words to do with the weighing of precious metals. So Daniel is not just translating these words, he's really interpreting the message, telling Belshazzar what the significance of the words are, what message God Most High is sending through these words. Many means God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. The fact that it's repeated suggests that this is going to happen quickly. Belshazzar thought he was secure in his kingdom, even though he knew that actually, as he was having this party, the Medes and Persians were gathered outside the city, just outside the gates. But the Babylonians believed that their city was impregnable. It had very thick walls and gates. The river Euphrates flowed through the middle of the city, so there's always going to be plenty of water. The food stores of the city were well stocked. Ancient historians tell us that the Babylonians thought their city could survive a siege of 70 years. So Belshazzar felt secure, even though the enemy was at the gates. But God said, many, many, your days are numbered. And when God says, your days are numbered, well, your days are numbered. So that's the first two words. Then, tekel. Tekel means you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. God had seen Belshazzar's actions, and God had seen his heart. God saw that he'd been unwilling to humble himself before him, even though he knew all that had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, and he'd refused to learn from his experience. Using the holy vessels from the temple in Jerusalem to worship the false gods was just like the final straw. The final straw in a life that God had been constantly weighing. His life had been weighed in God's scales and had been found to come a long way short of God's perfect standard. Then finally, farsin, or peres in the singular form as Daniel uses, means your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So we have Belshazzar, a doomed king. The verdict on the wall, that spelt that out. Then finally, we have Belshazzar, a dead king. didn't take long for the sentence of God, of the verdict that was on the wall, being carried out. That night, the Medes and Persians entered the impregnable city of Babylon. While he was partying, the Medes and Persians, as I said already, were at the gate. And Belshazzar knew that, but what he didn't know was that upstream in the river Euphrates, the Cyrus the Persian had ordered his men to divert the river. And they had done that. They diverted the river Euphrates from its course, so that during the hours of darkness, the soldiers of the Medes and Persians were able to walk up the relatively dry riverbank under the walls and into the city of Babylon and take it without a fight. And that night, Belshazzar was killed. The judgment that was on the wall was carried out. So that's Belshazzar, the sad case of Belshazzar. But what has it all got to do with us in the 21st century? Well, there are three things, I'm sure there are more, but there are three things that we can learn for our encouragement or for our challenge from this passage. First of all, God's king is in charge. We see in this passage the same message that we find in the whole of the book of Daniel, and that is that God's king is in charge. We'll be singing of that in Psalm 2 to finish our service, that God has set up his king in heaven, ruling over the universe. And that king, of course, is his anointed one, his holy one, his only son, Jesus Christ. He brings down one king and raises up another according to the purposes of his will. And he does these things also for the good of his people. And this bringing down of Belshazzar was for the good of his people. How did the bringing down of the Babylonian Empire help his people? Well, in bringing down the Babylonian Empire and raising up the Persians, God was bringing about a situation whereby his people would be enabled to return to the promised land after 70 years in exile. We read in the first verses of the book of Ezra of how God stirred up the king of Persia, Cyrus, to send the Jews back to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And he even brought those sacred vessels out from the storehouse and sent them back to Jerusalem, to the temple. So God's king is in control, and he works all things for his glory and for the good of his people. In the past 2 years, we've had a worldwide pandemic and now a war on the continent of Europe. And we might be tempted to think that things are out of control and they may get worse and worse. And indeed, they may get worse, but they're not out of control. For God's anointed king, King Jesus, is on the throne of the universe, and he's continuing to govern things for his glory and for the good of his people. So we don't need to be despair or be unduly worried. The world is in good hands. It's in the best hands possible, hands that were pierced through for the iniquities of his people. So we can be encouraged that God's king is on the throne. We can be encouraged also by the example of Daniel in this situation. Daniel is such a contrast to Belshazzar. He has been in Babylon as a captive for a long time. He came as a teenager and now he's an old man. But his best days are still to come, if you could think that Daniel in the lion's den comes in the next chapter. He had risen to great prominence in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, when by God's enabling he had told Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of his dream. But it appears now, as I've said before, that he's out of favour in Belshazzar's administration. But just look at some of the words that the Queen Mother uses in verse 11 when she describes Daniel. She uses words like the Spirit of the Holy God is in him. She uses the word light, understanding and wisdom. What an impression Daniel had made on these heathen people. He stood out, and his godliness shone through in everything that he did. You probably remember how in the next chapter, chapter 6, those who worked with him were trying to find some fault with him in order to get him into trouble with the king. But they couldn't find anything wrong in the way that he did his work. His work was beyond reproach. We need to ask ourselves if, to any degree, we are like Daniel. are our lives beyond reproach as far as faithfulness and integrity are concerned. The encouragement of the passage is that God's people serving him faithfully wherever he has placed us can have a much bigger impact than we could ever dare to imagine. In Daniel chapter 5, Daniel's faithfulness gives him an opportunity to talk to over 1,000 of the key people in Babylon about his God. What an opportunity Daniel got, and it was because he had lived a life of faithfulness all his days. Finally then, we come to a more personal application, and a more solemn one as well. Because many, many tekel pharsin are appropriate words for our lives too. Many applies to us because all our days are numbered. We know that. We just sometimes don't like to think about it. We don't know what the number is. Moses in Psalm 90 prays, "Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom." Like Belshazzar, our lives can be snuffed out in a moment. So we need wisdom to make sure that we have settled the most important issues of life. Not how much money we've made or what kind of legacy we've left behind, but what our relationship with the Most High God is. That's the most important thing for us to sort out, given that our days are numbered. So many applies to us. Tekel also applies to us because we've all been weighed in God's balances and found wanting. God has, in summary, given us two simple laws to keep. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. They're simple to say, but very difficult to keep. In fact, we know that we've all failed miserably to keep them. So tekel applies to us. We've all been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And farsin applies to us because by nature we're all disqualified from the kingdom of God. We're all disqualified by nature from life in heaven, from eternal life, because of our sin, which we all have by nature. So are we doomed like Belshazzar was? Is there no hope? Well, of course, there is hope, but that hope is not in ourselves. Think again about the words of the Queen Mother about Daniel in verse 9. "There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God." Thankfully, there is a man who fits that description even better than Daniel did, and that man is the God-man, the God's Son, Jesus Christ. He was the only one who was ever weighed in God's balances and found not to be wanting. He kept those commandments perfectly, the ones that we break repeatedly. And he was willing that God write many, many tekel pharsin over his life in order that God wouldn't have to write it over our lives if we're trusting in him. To receive that blessing, we need, like Nebuchadnezzar of old, to humble ourselves and to cry out to God for mercy. Belshazzar's story is in Scripture as a warning to others not to act as he acted and not to presume on God's patience. He had seen God transform his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, but he himself was unchanged. None of us will probably defy God in exactly the way that he did, but sadly it's possible for someone to defy God, not in a drunken, idolatrous orgy, but just by living your life quietly, but leaving God out of the picture. In Stuart Olliott's book on Daniel, there are a couple of very solemn paragraphs I just want to read in closing, and I quote, "The road which unconverted people walk has an invisible line across it, a line seen by God alone and not by us. God is patient and long-suffering with those who neglect and despise him. He gives them many opportunities to turn to him. He invites them to come to him and pleads and beseeches and persuades. His consistent desire is that the unconverted should turn around and seek him rather than continue to walk away from him. Those who persist in walking this road, they have chosen one day cross that invisible line. They cross the thin boundary between God's patience and his wrath. At last he says, 'Enough is enough,' and gives them up." End of quote. That's what happened to Belshazzar. Please don't let it happen to you. Turn today and seek mercy from God through the Lord Jesus Christ.